Welcome to this week's episode of Off the Assembly Line. I'm your host, Rebecca Reed, and every week I sit down for possibility-sparking conversation with innovative educators and entrepreneurs who are bringing the future to education, one beautiful disruption at a time. Hey guys, thanks for joining me for this week's episode. I don't think I'm overstating it when I say that this episode is essential listening. I'm honored to be talking with Julia Freeland Fisher, Director of Education at the Clayton Christensen Institute, renowned speaker, and author of the book Who You Know, which is a true must-read for all educators, and I rarely put that stamp on a book. For years, the education system has worked to address the clear disparity in outcomes for students on either end of the socioeconomic spectrum. We've known this disparity as the achievement gap, and more recently and accurately as the opportunity gap, but so far, significant national, state, and local investment has done little to actually close the gap and increase equity across the board. In this episode, Julia shares what her years of research have revealed. An actual X factor, a true linchpin in the achievement opportunity gap equation, and how schools can use innovative solutions to close the gap for good. It's intuitive and surprising all at once, and I guarantee you'll have at least one light bulb moment, but probably more. Today we're talking about the pivotal potential of student social networks. Here we go. Julia, I am thrilled to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Rebecca. Excited to chat.
Yeah, I am as well. So you're shining a light on a dynamic of student opportunity that really might just be the linchpin and until now hasn't really been a central part of the conversation. And you wrote a book on it. But before we go there and talk about what that is, I'd love to start with you and your journey. What has your story looked like and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I love that question. I tend to start every talk I give because I study students' access to networks with how did you get here and who helped you? So I'll answer my question a little bit, not just in the linear progression of my resume, but in who helped me get here. So I currently am the Director of Education Research at the Clayton Christensen Institute, where I study innovations in education. And my path here was definitely winding, but when I look back, education was a huge emphasis in my family, at times to a fault, to the point that sort of dinner table discussions were always really rich with debate and intellectual fodder. And I grew up just with a deep appreciation of learning. One of the signals of how crazy my family was that I wasn't actually allowed to go to Disneyland until I had created a timeline of the entire world starting in 5000 BC.
So, I love that.
So learning was always like sort of present in my life. But when I got to the job market, my first job out of college was at a place called New Schools Venture Fund, which is a venture philanthropy that supports entrepreneurs in education. I realized how much learning was only part of the story of who gets what. And realized very quickly, sort of looking at how education reform was unfolding, that networks and mentors and relationships play a huge role. And I benefited at New Schools Venture Fund from the mentorship of an array of people who are still to this day some of my greatest mentors and friends. But, you know, I was 22 and couldn't even have sort of called that out at the time it was happening. But fast forward how I got to this sort of job today, I took a detour, an expensive, misguided detour through law school. And while I was in law school considering what to do next, I went to one of those mentors from my previous job and said, am I allowed to try and synthesize what I see happening in education? Is there a job there? Is that a job? Ooh. Is that a legitimate pursuit? And like a good mentor, she really gave me permission to do that. And so a lot of the time when I think about students' access to networks, I think about my own story, not just back to those dinner table discussions and sort of a supportive, rich learning environment, which I think we talk about a lot in education reform, but also around who are the people who take a bet on you and who give you permission to take big leaps in your life.
Wow, that's so rich. Your family sounds very Kennedy-esque in the dinner table conversation.
I don't know about that. They are like super Catholic, if that's correlated. But.
Well, there you go. Oh, goodness. Well, you know, I love that you kind of stepped back and said, hey, can I synthesize what I'm seeing here? And I think that we're seeing more and more people ask for permission in that space, give themselves permission in that space. And I'm excited to dig into what it was that you saw that you wanted to synthesize. So last year, you released your book, Who You Know. It's all about student social networks, all about student relationships and how it correlates to their opportunity, their ultimate success. Can you talk a little bit about the book from a high level and what it aims to do?
Absolutely. So really our operating hypothesis going in, and there's a lot of research and data to back this, is that opportunity really sits at the cross-section of what students know and whom they know. And if you look at particularly the past 20 years of standards-based education reform, we have been so squarely focused on what students do and don't know that we have this sort of looming blind spot around their access to networks. And that's both networks of support and care that any young person needs to sort of healthfully develop, but it's also networks into the increasingly turbulent knowledge economy. And it's networks into a diverse array of careers. One of the statistics that undergirds all of that is that an estimated half of jobs come through personal connections. And if you looked at LinkedIn data, that actually goes upwards of 80% of jobs coming through referrals. Mm. So we can hammer away at achievement gaps and ought to and need to think about how are we ensuring that students, particularly those furthest from opportunity, are acquiring the skills and knowledge that they need to thrive. But if we ignore that social side of opportunity, we're not going to make a dent in some of the troubling patterns of inequality that I think many people in the education system are hoping we can cure over time.
Up to 80% of jobs from referral. That is a staggering number.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's problems to that, right? That we should be thinking about what should employers be doing differently on the hiring side. But I'll say where I am sympathetic to employers now being one, right, is that it's not crazy as an employer to want to hire a known quantity. Mm-hmm. And right now we have a couple ways of doing that. We have degrees, which are arguably an okay but quite broken signal of someone's skill set. And we have networks. And what we look at as we've studied innovations that expand students' access to networks are not just sort of like, oh, students need to go to more mocktail or cocktail parties, right? It's not networking in the sort of transactional sense. It's what does it mean to put more students in relationship with more prospective employers in more predictable and equitable ways so that they do become a known quantity, and so that both on the employer side and the student graduate side, they sort of know what they're getting. And that I sort of hope can curb some concerns that we're saying the fact that 80% of jobs come through referrals is a good thing. I think it's a little bit of a fact of life that we need to better design our system around.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting that you mentioned the word transaction. And I think that, you know, when we say the word network or networking,
yes,
you know, that kind of traditional, yes, cocktail, mocktail, I'm introducing myself and sharing a little bit so that I can get something from you. You know, but you mentioned what we really want to move toward is relationship. And in that is, you know, this dynamic of reciprocity and generosity. And I don't know if we want to get too deep into that now, but I'm curious what you would see as being some of the marked difference between that old model of transaction versus this new model of relationship.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's something we're increasingly spending time on. One of my favorite sort of frameworks that really breaks this down, I think, in a meaningful but also rigorous way is the work of a group called the Search Institute out of Minnesota that's looked at developmental assets for a long time as part of sort of youth development research, but more recently in the past decade has put out the developmental relationships framework. And what they do is they break down the different dimensions of a high quality relationship between a young person and an adult. And I think for a lot of us who have spent time in youth development, one dimension is care, right? And authentic care for the other person. Mm-hmm. But what's cool about their framework is that they also have dimensions like expanding possibility and sharing power. And those dimensions start to get deeper into what I think you were getting at, Rebecca, around authentic connection and mutuality and sort of what it truly means to be a human being in relationship. And it's a framework that I think can help educators and, you know, support staff in schools actually hold themselves to account that, like, care may not be enough, right? Mm-hmm. Like, care is not a fully authentic relationship, but there's all these other dimensions along which we can start to be in more holistic relationship with young people, and where young people can likewise be in relationship with adults, and rather than see them as sort of distant authority figures. So it's something we think a lot about, and it's a huge component of, as we look at innovative programs and tools, we're excited about programs and tools that are opening up just access, but we're also starting to look under the hood to say, what are the processes you have in place to ensure that these interactions really do have that rich underpinning of authenticity? The last thing I'll say there is, when we're looking for efficiencies, which we tend to do in the education system because it's so resource constrained, I think we sometimes short circuit trust. Mm-hmm. And we go straight to transaction, and we don't do trust building on the front end. And we've started to look at some of the research on empathy as well, which highlights a lot of the ways in which similarity breeds trust. And that if we can come up with protocols and tools and processes by which young people and the new people that they're meeting can actually surface similarity on the front end of those interactions, you've actually planted the seed of trust that can hopefully grow over time, rather than just assuming that, like, hours logged with someone is trust built, which we know is not actually the case. And so I could obviously talk about this authenticity piece for a long time, because I think it's in some ways the heart of the matter, and it has to then be paired with new access points to networks, which is a lot of what we've looked at over the past few years.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And that's really a really rich concept and a really deep concept. And I definitely want to circle back to that once we start getting into a little bit more of the concepts within the book and what schools can be looking at moving forward. But so I'm going to put a pin in that word trust right there, and we'll definitely come back to it. Great overview of the book. Thank you so much for just painting a picture and talking about what it aims to do. I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, going back to when you said, hey, can I step into this space and synthesize what I'm seeing? Where, for you, where does this book come from? Why did you write it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I mean, I was coming out of working at an organization and spending time in a space that was really focused on at New Schools Venture Fund, focused on closing the achievement gap and supporting schools and tools and human capital models that were moving in that direction. And yet I was also experiencing, in some ways for the first time, as naive as this sounds, the power of networks in my own work, in all of my friends graduating college and trying to get jobs. And I just saw this profound disconnect. That we were using test scores as a perfect proxy for opportunity, even though there was the social side of opportunity. So that was one factor that I felt like I had been steeped in this mental model of improving schools that was missing a social component. The second factor was I was deep when I first joined the Christensen Institute and started looking at emerging innovations. I was actually not at all staffed on social capital research. It was definitely my side hustle at the beginning. I was staffed at looking at the growth of education technology in classrooms and instructional technology, which was by then, this was in 2013, you know, a fairly booming market with a lot of excitement, hope, many would say hype,
right,
around the emergence of those tools. And I kept racking my brain that in our adult lives, we were using technology to connect at the press of a button. But when you looked at the mainstream edtech market, we were looking primarily at content delivery, assessment, and productivity tools. And we weren't using edtech to connect, which just felt like a disconnect to me. And so I started, before this was even a book, it was just a question, I started to track down any and all tool I could find in the technology market that was putting a new relationship within reach for young people. And so the convergence of this feeling that there's this looming asset of social capital that we're not paying enough attention to. And there's this tiny but promising market of technology tools that could put more relationships within reach, sort of started over the years to come together into what eventually became a book about not just tools, not just opportunity gaps, but really what it means to build a more networked and caring school system.
Oh, I love it. So fascinating on so many levels. Diving into the book a little bit here, you know, you really start off by laying out a great look at some of the most current research we have and where some gaps are starting to show themselves. So we've got loads of research on the impact of economic disparity, the achievement gaps, you know, and how that correlates to student opportunity. But you know, the way we've been talking about it doesn't quite tell the whole story.
Yeah.
So, and you've been hitting on this a bit, but what do student relationships have to do with this opportunity success equation? And what is the research showing us?
So when it comes to the role of relationships and access to opportunity, I've obviously cited that when it comes to job getting, networks matter. And most of us as adults can sort of appreciate that fact, even if like me, we learned it a little late in the game.
Mm.
But the power of this for those of you working sort of deep in the education system is that at almost every juncture along a young person's sort of developmental and educational path, relationships matter immensely. So early career exposure shapes the sorts of career ambitions young people have starting as early as elementary and middle school. Developmental relationships that I mentioned from the Search Institute framework, those are predictive of all sorts of things like attendance and grades and health. Access to a caring adult is one of the key buffers that prevents students from dropping out of high school and one of the key predictors of whether they re-enroll. Access to networks of people who have attended college and can support students through the Byzantine college application and sort of access process are key levers for increasing post-secondary enrollment. And access to near peer mentors have been shown to be a key lever for increasing post-secondary attainment. And so when we look at that data, again, we have all of these metrics along which we've arguably struggled to address achievement and attainment gaps. And at every step along the way, relationships are a critical asset to helping students succeed along that pipeline. And I think that piece, the reason why that's important to acknowledge is not because there are middle school teachers who would say relationships don't matter. Everyone sort of agrees that relationships matter.
Right.
As a system, though, we don't look at that in the whole and think about how do we reliably, routinely, and equitably consistently invest in student social capital along the way such that they graduate not just skilled but connected. So that we're sort of at every juncture filling their reservoir of social capital, not just throwing a mentor or a near peer or an educator at a problem at a single point in time. Now, on the data side, so that's the sort of research on why relationships matter, if anyone needed to be convinced. On the data side, I always cite what I call slim but troubling data on the state of students' access to relationships. So we can cite sort of constantly off the cuff our data on academic achievement, graduation rates, post-secondary attainment rates. There's less data out there on students' access to networks and what that looks like. But here are some of the, I think, alarming statistics. The first is that parental education level is predictive of students' access to the knowledge economy in that students are inheriting their parent and guardian's networks. And affluent parents and well-educated parents with a college degree or more are twice as likely to know a CEO, a professor, a congressperson. Whether you want to know a congressperson in 2019 is a separate conversation altogether. But they have these networks that they can then share, pass on to their children. And children with less educated parents don't enjoy that sort of luxury, those assets, as frequently. The other statistic that I think we should be alarmed by is all the research on growing gaps in enrichment spending. Affluent parents have sort of run amok when it comes to spending on out-of-school enrichment activities. And that in and of itself can explain disparities in sort of the sorts of experiences that students have exposure to and extracurriculars. But perhaps more troubling, it correlates with young people from less affluent families and in the lowest SES quartile reporting half the number of non-family adults in their lives. So coaches, teachers, religious leaders, music teachers, all of the sorts of people that if you have a robust extracurricular after school life, you come in contact with as an informal mentor. Our lowest income students are not enjoying those assets. And add all that together, if you think about not only the jobs research, but that pipeline research of relationships mattering along the way, we don't just have an achievement gap by income, we have a relationship gap.
Wow. I'm just, head is spinning a little bit with what all of this means. And by the way, how intuitive it is that you referenced the graph in your book that talks about, and you just reference this, but talks about the difference in parental access to different kinds of people, you know, the congressperson, the religious leaders, and so on and so forth. It's such a stark difference, and looking at it visually really was shocking, but at the same time, it's so intuitive that you just say, well, of course that's the case. So here's what I'm wondering. It is so intuitive when we stop and pause and look at what's there, even without the research, you know, if we just kind of reflect back on our own life experiences, it's so intuitive. And yet we are handcuffed almost to this idea of meritocracy. What is it in our collective psyche that makes us unwilling to let go of that and sort of embrace this idea of how significant relationships really are? I mean, is it our fear of nepotism? What is it that keeps us kind of resistant to it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a deep philosophical question for a little afternoon chat over Skype. But I think it's a couple things. So first of all, I actually dug into this concept of meritocracy when I was writing the book, because I have your same reaction of like, what's the stronghold that's keeping us from just being candid about this? Meritocracy is a word that was actually invented in 1958 as part of a satirical commentary by a British sociologist. And yet, if you like in America, if you look at sort of survey polls, like people are wedded to this concept, even though, again, it like was born out of basically like a super esoteric joke that someone was making about the sort of myth of the idea of meritocracy. So the sort of rugged individualistic American culture, I think, has glommed onto this concept as a big part of our national identity. We are the country most likely in the developed world to ascribe to belief in meritocracy. And so that's not an explanation as to why, but it's confirming what you're saying, that there's a stickiness of this concept. And I think where I will say I have some, I don't want to say data, but some information to sort of reflect back on why this is then perpetuating maybe a hesitation to or a hesitancy to invest in networks, is that enter schools who have been asked to be the great equalizer, right? And we've decided that to have a more meritocratic system, we just need to make sure that people have access to equal education. And the definition of equal education over the past two decades of education reform has been made equivalent to teaching reading, math, and other academic subjects and earning a diploma, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's been slippage in, we believe in meritocracy, we've decided that schools are the apparatus to ensure it, and yet we've narrowed the purpose of school to be purely academic, and sort of that just allows us to perpetuate our belief that we're living in a quasi-fair system. So it's not a tidy answer, but it's one that I think it's the right question to ask. And I think until those people who are in power and are well-networked can be honest about the ingredients that got them where they are today, it's a little bit going to be the status quo bias of not just our schools, but our society.
Yeah, I mean, super complex question, but I think you did a really good job hitting down at some deep, deep roots, which is, you know, our collective identity. And anytime anything threatens that, we are, you know, even individually, when something threatens our identity, we are very quick to clamp down and hold on and become defensive. But yeah, the way you described it sounds very much like a vicious cycle.
Exactly. It reinforces itself a little bit.
Yeah. So not simple answers, not a simple question, but one I think we definitely should be asking. And thanks for digging into it for a minute there with me. getting back to the book and the idea of student social capital, you talk about weak ties and strong ties. And this is a concept that I was actually introduced to by Shabri Raja, who is the founder of NEPRIS. And I was fascinated by it and really what it means for students, for all of us. Can you talk a little bit about weak and strong ties and the difference?
Absolutely. I can talk a lot about it, unfortunately, but I will keep this brief. So this became a really important concept, particularly when we were studying the role of technology, and I'll explain why in a second. But essentially, for decades, sociologists have made this sort of loose distinction, I would say, but it's language that a lot of sociologists use, between what they dub strong ties and weak ties. And typically, strong ties, if you think of a network as a sort of web with a dense center that becomes sort of dispersed as you go outward, strong ties are the folks in that dense center with whom you're spending the most time and theoretically maintain the highest levels of trust and care. They're the folks that are most likely to look out for you, not just emotionally, but financially. Your strong ties, therefore, are like quite valuable, right? So my husband is a strong tie who I lean on a lot, I rely on a lot. They also tend to be the ties that take up the most of our bandwidth, right? So we spend a lot, and that's no offense to my husband, but he is a high bandwidth spouse. and so that is one type of tie. And then the distinction between strong and weak ties is that our weak ties are the people with whom we spend less time, that we rely on potentially less in that sort of vein of care or at literal access to money and support. But the big aha that happened decades ago when a researcher named Mark Granovetter went out to study how people were accessing new jobs was something that he dubbed the strength of weak ties, which is that although these ties are maintained to a lesser degree from a time and bandwidth investment, they are actually more likely to offer us new information and opportunities. And the reason for that is that they are more plentiful, right? So probabilistically, the likelihood that one of my weak ties would have a new piece of information goes up as the number of weak ties I have goes up. And in addition, they are less likely to know one another the more expansive that network becomes, whereas your strong ties are more likely to contain redundant information, right? So my closest friend and my husband and I all tend to sort of know a lot of the same people, know about a lot of the same opportunities. So if I'm looking for new information and opportunities, I'm actually better positioned if I turn to my weak tie network than my strong tie network. And because they're lower bandwidth, I can maintain far more weak ties than strong ties, right? One husband, many LinkedIn connections. And so with that being said, thinking about our education system, I actually think we have a strong and at times disproportionate bias towards strong ties, right? Because many educators got into this work because they want to be in deep relationship with students. When you look at youth development research, we've been beating this drum for decades that access to caring adults and a web of care is critical for healthy development. So I think people are bought into the value of strong ties. What I think has been missing historically is an appreciation for that strength of weak ties, and that a brief connection can still actually offer real value to young people. And so fast forward, as I was doing that scan of the technology market and trying to understand what does it mean to use education technology to connect, very quickly we arrived at this would be a disaster if we were trying to use virtual relationships as a surrogate for the strong ties that young people need face to face for healthy development. But this is an immense advantage and opportunity if you think about diversifying weak tie networks using the likes of virtual mentoring, bringing outside experts into classroom over video chat, having conversations like you and I are over Skype. There's a huge opportunity there to start to diversify weak tie networks and therefore diversify access to opportunities and information otherwise out of reach.
Yeah, it's a perfect fit thinking about the potential power of ed tech in this gap of weak ties. I want to go back a little bit to the parent networks. You talked about the inherited network. So what does that gap look like? You know, not just the socioeconomic gap, but also maybe even rural-urban gaps or regional gaps. What does that inherited network dynamic look like when it's kind of played out into weak and strong ties? I don't know if I asked that question very clearly.
Yeah. No, I understand the question. And to be super candid, Rebecca, there's just not great data on it. There's some data to suggest that more educated parents have slightly larger networks, which, not to get overly into the research, but given how high bandwidth a strong tie is, as your network gets larger, it doesn't mean that you have more and more and more strong ties. It likely means you have more and more weak ties, right? Mm-hmm. So that would slightly suggest, but I'm inferring now, that more educated parents have broader weak tie networks that they mm-hmm. can then dial up old college buddy and like ask for an internship for their kid. It would be the sort of example. But just to be super candid, there's just not great data on this that's sort of nationally representative. So I don't want to overstate what we do and don't know.
Empirically. Sure. Absolutely. Okay.
But, sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
One thing I'll say there, just, I think there's a different dimension there where we can make some statements. And I alluded to sort of knowing CEOs, professors, congresspeople, which is one thing we're paying a lot of attention to as we look at promising new models is the diversity of types of connections that young people either inherit or access through other means into sort of the job market. And I think that's something to pay attention to when you ask that question of if you can expand young people's access even to weak ties, but across a diversity of career sort of paths or industries, you're actually setting them up for greater optionality down the line. Mm-hmm. And again, if we infer that based on the fact that more educated parents have slightly larger networks, that they are offering not just sort of quote unquote better networks, but more diverse ones that afford their kids options, that's a dynamic to really pay attention to. And again, one where if we can diversify weak ties, we're actually going to start to level the playing field in new ways.
Yeah, absolutely. At the simplest levels, we're really just talking about increased exposure to what's out there in the world, to who's out there in the world, to the kinds of jobs that are out there in the world, the kind of work that there is to be done. And when I was in the classroom, I was really struck by how significant this broad idea of exposure was for my students, for the way they thought, for the way they dreamed, for the way they processed information, for the way they interacted with each other, the way they felt about themselves. Really, I was blown away, I think, by how impactful that one very simple idea was. And I think that's maybe what we're getting to a little bit here when we talk about diversification of these networks, is really just exposing students to all that's available to them.
Yeah. And to be honest, you know, when I was growing up, and you may have experienced similar things, exposure was tantamount to, I walked into the classroom and there was like a poster with like a female nurse and a male fireman. You know what
100%,
I mean?
100%. Like yeah.
Exposure was this sort of, not only was it problematic in like gender and representation ways, but it was problematic because it was static.
Right.
And what we are sort of tracing is relationship-based exposure, actually getting to interact with someone who works in a given industry, may or may not lead to an enduring relationship where you then get a job, but it creates the possibility of that, if
right.
that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And those relationships could get stronger over time. And so this is not the term I want to coin because it's way too many syllables, but this idea of like sort of relationship-based exposure as important, distinct and important ways than just conveying information to students.
Yes.
Is a lot of what we're increasingly looking at as people rightfully are saying career exposure matters. What do we do about it? And we're trying to say, this is not just an information gap. It's again, a relationship gap that could be solved in exciting, innovative new ways.
Mm. Oh, I love it. And it gets me like so on fire. So what about schools? What can schools do to start leveraging this knowledge, you know, about student social capital, weak and strong ties? What does this look like? And maybe in easy grab ways first, and then moving into some more complex opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's three big buckets of innovation that we're sort of paying attention to right now. The first, and all of them, I would say, are probably areas where schools are dabbling. I think it's really important to say that like schools are already brokers of social capital. They're already dealing in relationships every day. What we're looking for are, what are some of the deliberate tools and new approaches where you could really turn up the volume on relationships, both inside the building and access to relationships beyond the building. So these are the three big buckets that we're looking at. The first is integrated student supports, which is a little bit of like the wonky research name for wraparound services, which is not a new concept at all. But the most powerful of those models that we've studied, the one that we highlight in the book is called City Connects, which came out of Boston College and the Boston area is now a national model. The most powerful of those models are student support and intervention structures that ensure that each and every student has a web of care around him or her, and that are we hypothesizing leading to a phenomenon wherein teachers actually know their students better because they're part of that web of care. We can talk more about like the sort of mechanics of that, but that's one big bucket. And so for any school running any sort of intervention and support structure, particularly for their struggling students, thinking about ways where that can be not just a matter of referring the student and his family out to a service provider, but actually being a strategic way to surround that student with a web of support is one sort of, I don't want to say low hanging fruit way, but sort of, opportunity for schools to step into this work more deliberately. Mm. The second big bucket that we've looked at is again around this idea of education technology that connects, ed tech that connects. And where I see a lot of possibility there is sort of threefold. These are the three places where that market is really maturing, and I think tools are becoming much more ready, kind of off the shelf for teachers and support staff to adopt. The first is a tool that you mentioned, NEPRIS, which is representative of a pocket of the market that's saying, look, educators, if you want to make your curriculum and your classwork relevant, you don't have to like plan a bunch of field trips or coordinate with a ton of guest speakers. You can, at the press of a button, have an industry expert from any industry port into your classroom and chat with your students for 15 or 20 minutes over video chat and spark that relevance and engagement in your content. So this idea of more flexibly bringing the real world into the classroom is starting to unfold in, I think, exciting and like low-hanging fruit ways. The second big bucket is around guidance and support. We all know that our student to guidance counselor ratios are abysmal right now. The recommended ratio is 250 students to one guidance counselor. The average national ratio is at, I don't know the current statistics, but last year was 1 to 482.
I was going to say, I think it's close to 500. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what that tells us from an innovation standpoint is that there are a lot of students not accessing the sort of time and support that they would most benefit from. And so we're starting to see technology come in, not as a replacement for those guidance counselors, God forbid we replace what's already a scarce resource, but a supplement where you have access to near peer mentors virtually who can help young people navigate the college application process or sort of the career decision process as they're coming out of high school, or in the higher ed space, navigate sort of career services, which has not quite as equally abysmal, but still abysmal student to career service representative ratios. And the last big bucket that we've looked at is in some ways the broadest, but is sort of the academic support market. And this can range from everything from tutoring to sort of caring apps where young people can access support that supplements sort of just educator supports in the classroom. And so those to me, again, they're predictably plugging into pockets of the market where schools are currently struggling to staff with limited budgets. And so it's a promising place where you're not using technology to replace your people, but you're using technology to bring more people to bear in young people's lives. The last bucket that we've looked at a lot, and I think that there's a ton of energy right now, particularly in the high school space, is around instructional redesign. So what does it mean if you're embarking on kind of rethinking your curriculum or instructional approach to ensure that that approach is a networked one, meaning young people in the course of learning are also connecting? The lowest hanging fruit here is if you're thinking about career exposure, job shadow, internship programming, thinking about how are you embedding a deliberate relationship component into those models such that we're not so sort of squarely focused on just teaching sort of technical skills in those, but we're actually leveraging an internship or an out-of-school learning experience to deliberately diversify a student's network. So those are three big buckets. The last one I'll say that we've spent less time on, but I just worked on an article on, so it's a little bit top of mind, is obviously social emotional learning has gotten, has a big bandwagon that's sort of taken off. And it's not my area of expertise, but one thing we're keeping an eye on in that space as states actually increasingly are pushing SEL outcomes is that a lot of social emotional learning efforts are focused on skills. still, right? And saying there are skill sets around intra and interpersonal relationship, self-regulation, things like that, that we need to more deliberately teach young people. And that those non-cognitive skills are actually incredibly important for all sorts of life success metrics. What I see happening there, though, is that if we don't talk about access to relationships alongside those skills, SEL interventions are not actually going to end up being an instrument for equity, because we can teach networking and relationship building all we want, but we also need to open the doors to networks. And so I'm most excited by SEL models that are teaching those skills, but in the context of brokering new relationships for young people, or much more deliberately brokering relationships within the school or the classroom in a measurable way. So, I mean, none of these are no work, but to me, they are following on to some of the energy already driving school improvement, and the opportunity is to really get explicit about how are we generating relationship outcomes alongside academic and SEL outcomes.
What, and tell me if this is getting off in the weeds a little bit too much, but you know, we started talking about the role of trust in the beginning of our conversation, and if there is a way to kind of characterize the role of trust in how schools are approaching these new initiatives or renewed initiatives, what would it be? What would it look like?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a fairly long history of sort of school culture improvement interventions where I think trust has been part of what's at play there. So I'm as a person who studies innovation, I'm always hesitant of declaring that like trust is not a new concept whatsoever, right? And good leaders have always recognized that trust is critical. I think we're at a point, though, particularly as we look at the role of technology, not as the only innovation, but one of the accelerants of this work, is that we could end up in a place where we scale distrust. If the only thing we focus on, assume you buy my premise that we actually need to start putting students in relationship more and more deliberately networking them into opportunity, if that's just a logistical challenge and we start sort of crashing people together without addressing particularly areas of difference, lines of difference that those relationships may be forged across, we could end up with a lot more connections and higher levels of distrust than we already have, which are like alarmingly high right now. And so that's why I appreciate your question, because it actually is a big quality indicator when I look at the design of new tools or new interventions. Like, I care in some ways less about whether you're putting a new relationship within reach and more about whether that relationship that you're putting within reach, you've created some sort of design that ensures trust. So here's a really tidy example of that. They may need to rebrand given the recent Me Too movement, but Empatico.org, which is a empathy intervention that has been spearheaded by the Kind Foundation, uses a protocol called Me Too Moments, where young people, and this is for forming empathy across lines of difference in peer-to-peer settings, so young people talking to peers from even other countries, and the young person will say something about himself, and then the other young person, if he or she shares that attribute, can say me too, and you've surfaced an area of similarity. And if not, the other young person says something and you go back and forth until you surface an area of hidden similarity. And the reason why that's so powerful is this idea of homophily in sociology, that similarity breeds trust. And it's a quick, simple protocol that, like, it doesn't solve for all of my concerns around scaling distrust, but it's at least an intentional design at the front end of a relationship that increases the likelihood that trust is being forged. So that's like just one example of, and I'm hoping as our research continues, we're not doing original research on trust, but we're constantly sort of combing the space for other kind of protocols like that, that hold the promise of, in some ways, very simple, very intuitive interventions that can increase the likelihood that there's a high quality relationship. The reason, I'll just end with this, not to end on a bleak note, but the reason why this is important is that if you look at the mentorship literature on sort of quality of relationships, a negative mentoring interaction between a young person and an adult, particularly if it's curtailed, if that adult sort of stops showing up, is actually worse than no relationship at all.
Mm-hmm.
It deteriorates that student's sense of self-worth, right? And so, again, this is a real risk that we need to keep an eye on, that trust is at least one quality indicator that we can nail up front, as opposed to waiting until we've done a bunch of like experimentation, scaled distrust, and have to sort of backpedal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's crucial. I'm so glad that you talked through that a little bit. Not that that was a bleak note, because it wasn't at all. I find it very hopeful. But let's get even maybe a little bit more idealistic if we can to start closing ourselves out here. If we look toward the future or ideal state or what this could look like if we were to envision something fully realized, what would that look like? Your book talks about this concept of walled gardens. We don't have to go super in depth in that as we're wrapping up our conversation, but I'd love to hear just a little bit about what that might look like.
Absolutely. So I think my hope for the future in the near term, we need to see a mindset shift, and it gets at whether it's upending this like bizarre myth of meritocracy that we're all deluding ourselves around or other sort of myths that animate our system. The big mindset shift that I am hopeful we will see in the nearest future is starting to re-embrace relationships as outcomes in their own right, not just inputs to learning and development. And as an education system, we've gotten to this place of just teachers or mentors or even peers being inputs to these test scores that we want to create. Mm-hmm. And we've lost our way that those relationships are incredibly powerful outcomes in their own right. And so I think once we start to get to that shift, all sorts of new designs, opportunities are gonna really blossom. And the concept of the walled garden, it's sort of the idea that schools will become for both privacy and safety of students and for sort of the quality control reasons we were talking about, will become much more sort of deliberate at nurturing a controlled but vibrant ecosystem of relationships for students. And what gets me super excited about that, this will show how wonky I am, but gets me super excited about that is that if you start to think about a school as a deliberate broker of relationships, suddenly schools will be incentivized and have ambitions to go into their communities and actually mm-hmm. start to tap into latent social assets that right now our schools are very ill designed to take advantage of, whether that's partnering with industry in much more deeply integrated ways than schools have managed to in the past, whether that's actually leveraging mentorship programs as partners as opposed to sort of competitors for funding, whether that's ensuring that students are actually able to go out into the community and learn and be part of a broader sort of society than just their classroom. All of that right now is latent value that we're leaving on the table in an already resource-constrained system. The last example I'll say, that there's a book by Mark Friedman that came out last year called How to Live Forever, which is all about age segregation and the fact that we have that our aging populations are these enormously vibrant assets that schools have like zero sort of channels to tap into, even though that's in fact, with baby boomers retiring, a growing volunteer base that our public education system could immensely benefit from if it were designed to do so. So that's really my hope of once you shift your mindset to think of relationships as outcomes and you look around, they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But we think so much about resources in education right now as merely dollars and cents and merely sort of textbooks and curriculum, and we've forgotten about all the human resources that our system could be designed to include and to leverage for young people, particularly those who are less connected.
I love that picture so much, and I feel the same way you do. Just get very excited about the potential and not only what that would do for schools, for students, for educators, but what that starts to do for communities then, you know, and beyond.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a weird disconnect where our schools are this totally separate
right.
Entity right now. And I think there's a chance to kind of reweave the relationship between society and school again, if we think of relationships as that bridge.
I'm getting this picture of a brain that is like starting to heal itself and making new neural connections and coming back to life in different ways. I don't know exactly what all that means and, you know, in this setting and what it would look like, but that's the image I have in my mind when I think about it. So
Exciting. Totally. I mean, I think it's like, not to be alarmist, but the macro trends that you look at that again should make this urgent work for all of us, not just educators, is there's data statistics just mounting levels of loneliness across the population, right? That our former U.S. Surgeon General called a loneliness epidemic. And so there is healing to be done. And I think, you know, the best case scenario is that we wake up to that and we start to invest in institutional structures, designs, tools, measures, all of those technocrat things that would actually unlock connection at unprecedented scale.
Oh, so good. So, Julia, who are you giving an A to these days?
Who am I giving an A to? Oh, my goodness. That's a really good question. I feel like it's been such a weird year in our national conversation that I'm like, I will just say, whenever I talk about the book, I have to give this shout out. I will say my husband, not just because I'm like, that's the only person I can think of, but he actually co-authored this book with me. And I was so excited to have a co-author, not just because it was my husband and we had a lot of fun writing it, but because we don't accomplish things alone in our lives.
Right.
And to put someone else's name and someone who I care about so deeply, put someone else's name on this book, to me was trying to signal that like, none of this could have happened without a whole bunch of support from a whole bunch of people that came before my husband signed on to the book, but also with his help. So I think I'm consistently grateful for just having a thought partner in trying to architect this like totally complex, crazy argument that felt at times a little insane.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I have to say, I love that we came back full circle. I mean, you started off by saying, you know, where'd you come from and who helped you? And we're ending, on that same note. Fantastic. So as we close out, how can people get connected with you and what you're doing? How can they connect to your work?
Absolutely. So like I said at the beginning, I work for the Clayton Christensen Institute. We are at christenseninstitute.org. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Julia F. Freeland on Twitter. And as we are developing these ideas, we want to be in conversation with people who are pursuing them on the front lines and who are building tools and solutions and working directly in relationship with students. So always happy to chat one-on-one. I'm totally an introvert too. So I appreciate a one-on-one chat as frequently as possible.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I'll make sure that we put those links in the show notes as well. But Julia, this has been such a pleasure and honor. I've so enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Rebecca. Honored to be here.
Wow. So good. Thanks for listening to this powerful episode of Off the Assembly Line. A lot of knowledge and resources were dropped in this conversation, and you can find all of it at offtheassemblyline.co. If you liked what you heard, the best ways to support the show are to rate and review and share it with your network. I've got some great episodes coming up for you, but I'd also love to know what you're interested in hearing about. What are your burning questions? The disruption that you see is most needed in the ed system, or the people we simply have to hear from? Send me a message at offtheassemblyline.co, email me directly, or message me on LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from you. Until next week, you know what I'm going to say. Go make a ruckus.